Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Well, hello there. I just love my theme song. It was picked for me by Jack Inslee, who is now DJing down at the Line Hotel in Washington, D.C., where he is creating an amazing studio. But enough about that. This is What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights. I am your host, Katie Kiefer, and this is number two in our series on the dairy industry, with which I am kicking off the new year. And we're going to be talking today with Peter C. Carstensen, who is a professor of law emeritus. He's at the University of Wisconsin, Law School, where from 1993 to 2002, he served as Associate Dean for Faculty Research and Development. He's a graduate of the University of Wisconsin and received his law degree and master's degree in economics from Yale University. And from 1968 to 73, he was an attorney at the Antitrust Division of the United States Department of Justice, assigned to the Evaluation Section, where one of his primary areas of work was on questions of relating competition policy and law to regulated industries. He has been a member of the faculty of the University of Wisconsin Law School since 1973, and he is a senior fellow of the American Antitrust Institute and an expert on the dairy industry. And this is like my favorite topic, and I'm so excited that you are here with us today. Thank you so much for joining me, Peter.
Well, it's a delight to have a chance to talk about some of these issues that have interested me for years.
Obviously. And just before we really get into the interview, why is it that antitrust is not on the tip of everyone's tongue when it comes to looking at how industries almost across the board are consolidating? I mean, you should be very, very busy, sir.
it's closer to the tip of the tongue these days than it has been for many, many years. We're seeing more activity in Congress, more public discussion about competition law, which is not to say there's sufficient concern and recognition of these issues, but more and more data is coming out, all kinds of empirical work showing the harms to consumers and producers that have resulted from these increases in concentration and the allowance of anti-competitive conduct by the courts.
That's right. So let's start by just kind of taking listeners through what our antitrust laws and regulations have been, sort of like the history of the Clayton Act and the Capra-Volstead Act, which is essentially what still regulates antitrust law to this day. Isn't that right?
Certainly in agriculture, these are very important issues. We always need to start with the Sherman Act, which was adopted in 1890 and has not been changed. It prohibits conspiracies in restraint of trade or agreements that restrain trade and also prohibits monopolization. The Clayton Act was adopted in 1914 because of a feeling at the time that the Sherman Act was ineffective in protecting consumers and producers from abuses of market power. Its most important feature was a prohibition on any merger that may substantially lessen competition or tend to create a monopoly. Notice that's a much more inclusive standard. Unfortunately, because of the way the statute was drafted, it turned out to be totally ineffective for the next 50 years.
Wow.
In 1950, Congress revised the statute to make it effective. It took another decade until the early 1960s for it to become operational in terms of part interpretations. And for the next decade or so, we had a very robust merger enforcement program, which has then, in my view, atrophied. We are not nearly as active in enforcing that. Kapper-Volstead is another element here. Kapper-Volstead was adopted in 1921 or 22 in response to many problems in American agriculture and a concern that cooperatives might be regarded as violating the antitrust law. There's also the politics were that Congress was being lobbied very vigorously to provide direct subsidies to farmers, and instead the conservative majority said, oh, no, we aren't going to do that, but we'll exempt you from antitrust law if you set up a cooperative. Some of those participating in the debate, especially Senator Norris of Nebraska, a leading progressive, pointed out that most cooperatives didn't violate the antitrust law anyway, so that it was not entirely clear what farmers were getting as a result of that statute. But its effect is that if a cooperative satisfies certain criteria, including having only farmer members, it can be exempted from antitrust law for its legitimate business activities, I believe is the way the Supreme Court has now interpreted that.
Wow, fascinating. And wasn't the Sherman Act introduced largely to combat the consolidation of the meat industry in the 1890s?
Or well, am certainly I wrong that about was that? A major factor. The Sherman Act was a response to the beef trust, the whiskey trust, the tobacco trust, and, of course, Standard Oil, the oil and gas trust. Mm-hmm. There was also big concern about the dominance of International Harvester in the farm equipment world. And the key political support for passing both the Sherman Act and then later the Clayton Act came from rural America. It was the agrarian states and congressmen and senators who were the leaders in getting those pieces of legislation adopted.
Very interesting. I mean, and now there's a whole different sort of power center from that's dominating politics in those agrarian states that seems to have very little to do with small-scale farming. But we digress. There is another statute I want you to talk about briefly, and that's the AMAA. Can you tell us what that is?
Sure. That's the Agricultural Marketing Agreement Act. And it comes out of the Great Depression of the 1930s. It was adopted by Congress to facilitate two kinds of activities, one of which never really developed, which was private agreements among producers of agricultural goods, essentially to create a cartel. The second prong of the AMAA was to authorize, with the approval and under the supervision of the Secretary of Agriculture, the imposition of controls on the production of selected commodities. Milk being the most prominent one, but it includes things like cranberries, pie cherries, a number of other commodities, potatoes. Many of the major crops, corn, soybeans, cotton, were at that time given a specific subsidies. So Congress was appropriating various kinds of payments to farmers on one set of agricultural commodities, and then authorized the creation of these controls, and they can range and do range from efforts to set some standards of what's an acceptable peach or pear or whatever, what's an appropriate measure of quantity, and that standardization is very helpful for farmers because then you can transact with others because everybody will know what the commodity, what they're getting when they order something, when they buy something long distance. It has also permitted various groups to set various kinds of output controls. There are no direct price fixing authorized that I know of and under those statutes, but they can, with the approval again of the Secretary of Agriculture, impose restrictions on output. That is how much you can sell into the market, regardless of what you produce. And so it can have a series of anti-competitive effects from the from a consumer perspective of restricting access to commodities.
Mm, thank you for explaining that. I hadn't actually quite understood it from your paper, so I'm glad. Now I feel like I have a little more of a grasp of the concept. Now let's talk a little bit about how, because I did read that paper that's on your website. You wrote a lot about sort of how, about monopoly and consolidation in many agricultural products, but including meat and dairy. And I guess what I want to get at here is how parallel or how many parallels do you see or how much similarity do you see between what is happening now and what happened to cause Congress to pass these various statutes back at the turn of the 20th century? I'm kind of curious to see if we've really done a full 360 in terms of, you know, everything old being new again in terms of monopolization of certain industries. Would you say it's very similar now, or are there a lot of differences that you see?
No, I think you're absolutely right. We have gone, was it Back to the Future or something like that?
Yeah.
We're back with an industry structure in meatpacking that is at least as concentrated as mm-hmm. that which we had in the period right around World War I, when the Federal Trade Commission did a massive study of the meatpacking industry and found any number of major problems.
Sure.
Dairy has become far more concentrated, even though we can move milk much greater distances now because of the highway system, refrigerated trucks, so you could haul milk a long ways, and you'd think that might open markets up from what had been very highly concentrated local markets. Instead, what we see is the same concentration mm-hmm. made worse because there's nobody who, when they see an overcharge on consumers or underpayment to farmers, there's nobody out there that can make entry into that market area and capture the business that would otherwise be available to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I that's what I'm getting from the farmers that I talk to. And also and I also see the parallels between the meat industry and the dairy industry seem like, you know, really irrefutable. And but the only difference to me is that the beef industry specifically, for example, is not co-op. Meat people do not co-op. It's weird. They have the contract farming thing in the pork and poultry sectors. Beef is not so much. But they don't work as cooperatives in general. And I think that's kind of an interesting difference, even though they're so consolidated and dairy is so consolidated because of its co-ops, right? Am I making that up? But my understanding is like the Dairy Farms of America was meant to be sort of a mouthpiece for dairy farmers, and then it's turned into this gigantic, essentially price-controlling behemoth in the industry. And that, to me, seems very similar to what's happened in the meat industry. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, just to start with meatpacking involves more capital investment. There are some cooperative slaughterhouses out there. There's
a few,
at least one
yeah.
in Iowa. I think there's one cooperative pork processor. There was another major one that went bankrupt because management speculated in fertilizer.
Oops.
And then Smithfield was allowed to buy
right.
the
well Nyman
the
Ranch
co-op assets.
Nyman Ranch is a co-op, for example. That's a quite
pardon?
A big Nyman Ranch is a big and successful co-op,
yeah.
actually.
Yeah. So there are, but they've not had the same impact.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fair to say in meatpacking. Interestingly, in the meat world, somewhat comparable to the Capra-Volstead, there's another statute that we haven't mentioned, which is the Packers and Stockyards Act.
Oh, right, of course.
That Congress adopted to regulate the process of marketing livestock.
Mm-hmm.
And the courts have gutted that one
yes.
to deny meat packers, cattle feeders and poultry producers, the desired protection from unfair behavior. So it's kind of the history of the two industries in terms of meatpacking as we go forward from, say, 1900, already having a highly concentrated business operation. Dairy, because it was much more localized, mm-hmm. had more and made much. There was much more use made of cooperatives. I should add, going back to meat, especially beef and pork. There was a whole marketing system through stockyards, so mm-hmm. that there was a way for many years for producers to get the benefit of a workably competitive market for their animals.
Right.
That really didn't exist for dairy farmers. So that's why they tended to do two things: to set up various kinds of marketing co-ops to market their milk to fluid milk processors, the milk we drink.
Right.
And also they set up co-ops to make cheese or other manufactured goods mm-hmm. from milk. And those, the local cheese, again, because of how far you could haul milk on the bad roads that existed before, say, at least the 1940s, mm-hmm. Cheese companies were small operations. You set up a co-op, you had a cheesemaker, you'd have 10 or 15 farms contributing milk to that co-op. So it was a very different infrastructure situation into the post-World War II era. At that point, we begin to see both the consolidation of the milk processing business and consolidation at the retail grocery store level. And it's important to understand, if you've got fewer and fewer grocery chains, you've got fewer and fewer potential buyers
right.
of fluid milk, and that induces reduction in competition in the milk processing part of the market, which then reduces the number of buyers of milk available to farmers, at least for fluid milk.
Right.
And so you get this kind of concentration feeds back, you close out small cheese factories, then the farmer, it's harder and harder for a farmer to have a milk operation if they don't have viable outlets.
Right.
So that it's a whole cascade of consolidation from retail to processing, and then the farmer faces increasingly limited opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
In that context, then, the marketing-type cooperatives began to consolidate, and out of that emerged the Dairy Farmers of America, DFA, which has, last time I heard, it had more than 20,000 members spread across the United States. It is the dominant milk cooperative, and in many areas, it has effective control over access to milk, so that any small cooperative has to work through DFA in order to sell its milk.
Wow. So can they do what processors can do to dairy? So in other words, like if you're a processor and you don't like the price of meat that you're being offered, like say you're a rancher and you bring in your cattle and they say, well, okay, we're going to give you 12 cents a pound for this. And you're like, what? and then they really don't have any place else to go to process their meat, so they have to sell it at 12 cents a pound. That's what's happened in the meat industry. I actually did write a little book about this, so I'm pretty cool about the meat. But I'm so fascinated by the parallels between the way these two industries have consolidated.
Yep.
And so then, is that the same thing that happens with people who sign up with Dairy Farmers of America? Basically, they have no other place to go with their fluid milk, so they have to sign a contract with Dairy Farmers of America. They become a co-op member. And then they, again, are, okay, price of fluid milk, 15 cents a pound. What? But where else are you going to go with it unless you just have raw milk and sell it at the farmer's market, which I don't even, in many states, you can't even do that.
So right. And if you run a substantial dairy, you don't have You can't do that because you simply have got too much volume.
Right.
It's a little different in dairy. That is, what has happened is the DFA has gotten exclusive supply contracts with the yogurt makers, the big cheese makers, the big Dean Dairy Hood, et cetera.
Right.
Which means that other cooperatives with that represent small groups of farmers have no place to sell their milk until they make a deal with DFA. In some cases, they are allowed to retain their, quote, independence, unquote, but they have become part of a joint dairy marketing enterprise, which is managed by DFA and serves DFA's interests. In some circumstances, I am told, DFA has literally told a co-op, your members are going to now become DFA members, you're going to go out of business.
Wow.
So it has used its power that way. In terms of pricing, there are some protections in that the price for price for milk is set in base price for milk is set through a series of pricing formulas. This goes back to the AMAA, the Agricultural Marketing Agreement Act, which, if dairy farmers agree that they want a market order, the market order specifies that the USDA sets a base price for milk, and then milk used for fluid, or what we drink, carries a premium with it that is quite substantial in some states. So that there's a kind of floor of the pricing, except that the co-op is deemed to be the seller of the milk that gets the benefit of those prices. Uh-huh. It then passes payments back to farmers net of various charges. And that's where the problems have been highlighted in terms of potential abuse of farmers by, as a result of excessive charges for the testing of milk. You've got to test milk to make sure it's clean, that it has the right right fat content, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, there's a premium paid for milk that has particular characteristics over and above the set price. There are some other things that get involved here that bother me greatly. When there's insufficient supply of milk within one of these order areas, it is permitted to bring milk in, to truck it in from outside. That milk is paid the same price that it is paid for milk produced within the order area. And if you are in Wisconsin with relatively low order prices, and you can ship it into the southeast United States, which has very high order prices, you stand to make a lot of money, and they will often reimburse, or the order farmers have to also pay the cost of shipping.
Wow.
So it's, and DFA has in the past been accused, and I everything I've seen suggests that some of this is fairly accurate, of manipulating the supply of milk and favoring its friends, and in some cases having milk shipped from quite substantial distance into one of these higher price order areas, rather than moving milk from the next closest area. So you have a kind of you could have had a cascading effect that would have kept costs down and would have made sure that farmers in the more immediate area were being rewarded when there was an actual or a claimed shortage of milk.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that they will take milk from a far distance place, they will bring it into a high price place, but they actually extract the cost of shipping and cost of testing and probably other marketing costs that we're not discussing here. And then that sort of, you know, Midwest farmer will basically get the same crummy price that the guys down in the Southeast would get anyway. Am I understanding that correctly?
Except the guys in the South would get a better price because the milk in Wisconsin.
Right, because they wouldn't pay for the shipping.
The Wisconsin guy is better off if he's favored by DFA to ship his milk to South Carolina than if he has to sell it for use in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
If the problem is that sometimes there may have been a sufficient supply of milk in the Southeast, and so instead of those farmers getting the benefit of having more of their milk going for the premium usage, they get only 60-70% of their milk used for that. 30% get sold for cheese or other at the national price. There's a single price for all milk used for purposes other than fluid. So that's what harms the Southeast farmer or the New England farmer relative to some big operation in Indiana or Michigan or Wisconsin that can, or in some cases New Mexico, was shipping milk into the Southeast.
Mm.
So it's more the adverse effect on the farmer in the dairy farmer in the area where the milk is being shipped, rather because the shipping farmer is being made better off.
Wow. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Peter, stay with us, and we're going to have a little sponsor drop, and then we'll be right back to talk more about this, because this is really a very complex set of equations that you're presenting me with. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with Peter. thank you, with Peter Carstensen.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I am your host, Katie Kiefer. My guest today is Professor of Law Emeritus from the University of Wisconsin Law School, Peter C. Carstensen. And we're taking apart the dairy industry. This is part two of I don't know how many parts it's going to be, actually. I'm still lining up the guests, but believe me, we're going to take a deep dive into this industry because it's a major part of American agricultural efforts, and somehow dairy farmers are disappearing. And they're losing money, and I'm trying to figure out what the hell's going on out there. So, Peter, let's go back to the DFA, to the dairy co-ops, the DFA, Dairy Farmers of America. It's the biggest co-op in America. But so how is it that that dairy co-op seems to be, you know, essentially screwing its members, but other dairy co-ops seem to be doing great things for their members? Like, I'm thinking Organic Valley, for example. Would you consider them a good co-op or a bad co-op, or neither?
Again, it's always what you know at a distance, and then you need to, you know, when you get in uptight, there may be more issues. But certainly Organic Valley has a pretty good reputation, as best I know, for serving its members' interests well and carefully. And a number of co-ops do.
Sure.
something like Landmark in Maryland that draws heavily on Amish dairy farmers up into Pennsylvania is good operation. So, yeah, you can have a good co-op. The problem, as I've looked at it with very large co-ops, is the sort of separation of ownership from control. Yeah. You've got a set of managers who really are not very accountable to their members, because the members, again, 23,000 members, one vote each member, a very complex voting system, very poor reporting of detailed accounting data. There are all kinds of questions out there about the actual economic situation, financial situation of DFA, but it's impossible to get information. Even if you had that information, trying to organize some kind of a proxy contest where you've got 23,000 people, each with one vote, and nobody able really, you know, in the corporate world, somebody can say, I want to take over this enterprise, and I can make a lot of money. Well, that can't be done in a co-op situation, so that it's very ineffective governance, which means that when you get to be a very large enterprise with no supervision, there is no supervision at the USDA, there is no supervision through the states, so that they are essentially not accountable, even though there's some authority in the Secretary of Agriculture that could have possibly been used to make co-ops more accountable. It's not been used as especially accountable in the context of the use of the Agricultural Marketing Agreement Act. So you're left with a situation where if there is honorable management that is devoted to the best interest of the members, things go forward. When you have more questionable management that may be both self-seeking and wanting to advance the interest of its friends, then you wind up with really bad situations.
Which is what seems to be happening at dairy farms, because there was a big article in which you were quoted at the Washington Monthly this month by Leah Douglas that was really excellent. And I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but you were quoted in that article as saying that the Department of Justice is absolutely petrified of the dairy industry, and that's the only explanation for their failure to enforce antitrust law. So DFA, and in that article, Leah Douglas lays out essentially what appears to me the financial shenanigans of the DFA management team or executive team, in which they are, you know, building themselves these gigantic fancy offices and taking home gigantic amounts of money and getting golden parachutes right and left. And meanwhile, dairy farmers, even though they're members of that co-op, are not getting higher prices for their milk. And so I want to go back. We're going to talk about the DOJ in a minute, but I just want to go back for a second and talk about a little bit more about how those cooperatives control price and output for dairy farmers, because that's something that I am really curious about. I know that there's milk dumping going on to keep prices stable. I'm not quite sure how the farm bill fits into the pricing of dairy commodities. Can you sort of unpack a little bit of that for us?
Okay. I mean, one part here is, again, that this federal marketing order system depends for its basing price. The base price is derived from the price of cheese. The price of cheese, and this is primarily the dominant kind of cheese, is cheddar.
Yeah.
The price of that cheese is set by a set of transactions on the Chicago Board of Trade, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, I should say, which has a cheese auction. I think it's daily; it lasts about half an hour.
Wow!
Handles a infinitely small percentage of cheese actually moves through that market, but that's the price making source. What that means is that you can go in and manipulate the price of cheese by buying or selling cheese or cheese futures, cheese contracts on that exchange. Historically, it had been the exchange had been up at in Green Bay, where interestingly Kraft, mm-hmm. which buys about 30% of the cheese purchased in America, but it was a big seller on the Green Bay Exchange, affecting the price of cheese, driving it down, which, of course, then affected the price of milk.
Sure.
Willard Mueller, very distinguished agricultural economist, antitrust economist, put together that story, led to some litigation, showed how that manipulation worked. As a result, they closed the Green Bay Exchange, moved it down to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
All the evidence is that that the price of cheese on that exchange correlates at 99.9% or something like that with the price that the USDA comes up with nominally by interviewing a bunch of cheese makers as to what price they're getting for cheese.
Huh.
So the incentives now are for DFA at various times to manipulate
yeah.
upward or downward the price of cheese on that exchange. They've been nailed for some other kind of milk contracts that they manipulated. There's been a good deal of discussion of their cheese buying practices, again, to raise price or to lower price, depending on the incentives of DFA as an enterprise as opposed to the interests of dairy farmers.
Yeah, fascinating. I'm trying to make that connection between how you become a marketing enterprise determining milk prices and cheese prices when you're theoretically supposed to be serving the interests of your co-op members. It's clearly something is very askew there. Would you agree with that?
Yes. It would be very desirable to have a very very thoughtful review of how you price milk. I know that various economists and people with interests in the dairy industry have come up with alternative ways to do the pricing, so it would be less manipulatable and move us towards a better system. Again, looking at some of the contracting, wherever there's an order, the Department of Agriculture could prohibit exclusive dealing contracts
mm-hmm.
or could require that no cooperative have more than X percent of supply contracts in a marketing order
mm-hmm.
to ensure greater opportunity for different suppliers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of reforms that could be done, but it would require the political will to go forward and actually do some of those things.
Well, so now we are arriving at that question about, first of all, your quote about the DOJ being absolutely petrified of the dairy industry. Why do you say that? What do you think, why do you say that? Why do you think they're petrified?
Okay, I say that because of the history. And mm-hmm. it isn't the dairy industry at large. It's DFA.
Okay.
They did take on DFA in one case involving the acquisition of a small dairy in Kentucky, where they used their appellate brief to disclose some of the misconduct that was then going on in DFA. But with that, that's the exception.
Yeah.
The staff at DOJ. It is understood. Okay, I've never seen the documents. I'm never going to see the documents. But
yeah.
It is understood that the staff attorney, having conducted a major investigation, recommended a major lawsuit. This is in the Bush administration
uh-huh.
era. And was shut down and fired. And ultimately made a settlement where, as I understand it, where he got some significant compensation, career guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but under a confidentiality order, so
mm-hmm.
he's not to tell us anything about what he learned. The Southeast antitrust case came out of that, where after the private lawyers had put it together, one of those lawyers said to me at one point, you know, this is not just an antitrust violation. This is a felony that's going on.
Wow.
They went in and made a presentation to the Justice Department, and the Justice Department did nothing.
Wow. Even under the Obama
forward, I'm not going to be able to place that for sure, whether that's late Bush or early Obama. Mm-hmm. We certainly know, because the basis of both the Southeast private case and the New England private case was the Justice Department's internal records. Those resulted in many millions of dollars of settlement, not very good long-term relief, because private lawyers are not well positioned to demand really good long-term restructuring kind of relief. Come forward into the Obama administration, Christine Varney initially indicated that she was the first assistant attorney general for antitrust, that she was really going to focus in on co-ops and how they were behaving. And there's a mushroom co-op that did get sued, actually, under the, I think that was, the case was actually brought in the Bush administration. There were investigations in eggs, potatoes, quite possibly in dairy, in at least a new one in dairy. And Assistant Attorney General Varney made some statements about concern about how Capra-Volstead was being interpreted and the conduct of co-ops, and enormous political pressure was brought to bear. My understanding, and again, this is only, you know, this is what in the law we would call hearsay, because I was told that this was what was going on. It was orchestrated by DFA to bring an enormous amount of political pressure to shut down the government's interest in co-ops. We know that, in fact, Attorney General Holder, Assistant Attorney General Varney, pulled back and pulled out of doing anything, despite having a whole series of workshops in 2010 on agricultural issues. Mm-hmm. They pulled back, and I know from this, I have heard a little more directly, a staffer for a senator who did that senator's ag work, telling me that after the Varney indication of concern, the phone was ringing off the hook.
Wow.
By people calling in, and this is the end of all agriculture, you're going to kill the world if you don't stand back. So the political lesson was, Pull back.
Yeah.
Don't do anything. DFA has got some enormous political strength. It's not out there in public, but they've got congressmen and senators who are clearly their friends and will carry water for them and threaten agencies that try to control what they're doing. This affects the USDA.
Right.
Interest in using its market order authority to control things. That's it. Just so obvious, especially given the information that we have that has been disclosed in the various lawsuits, the information about how DFA has behaved over the last 15 years, not to have had any government and antitrust division enforcement effort is a sign that they're just scared out of their wits of taking on something that is an entity that is this politically powerful.
Well, I'm trying to think of just how much money they are throwing at these elected representatives in order to maintain their control over pricing and, you know, farming in general like that. And it's not, obviously, it's not just the dairy industry. The meat industry is the same. The pharmaceutical industry is the same. I mean, this is across agriculture. It's pretty much the same story. And it's just astonishing, you know, until we get, basically it comes down to until we get money out of politics, this is going to keep going.
Yeah.
Isn't that right? That's the solution, essentially.
Yeah, and it is very, very troubling. For example, late in the Obama administration, they finally put through some basic protections for meat and poultry producers that would have reversed some indefensibly bad decisions in the Court of Appeals.
Right.
And
that was the GIPSA, what was going on with GIPSA, right? With the Grain Inspection and Stock Care Act. It was a revamp of that.
No sooner did the Republicans come to office than those provisions were pulled back.
Immediately.
And eliminated.
Yeah.
And it's just very sad that basic protections cannot be provided at this point because of what seems to me to be gross misrepresentations about what's going on.
Yeah. Well, we're going to leave it at there. This is your opportunity to promote yourself shamelessly, so go right ahead. If you have things that you would like people to read or more information about this topic that they can elicit from you or some cause you want to, you know, support, go ahead. Now's the moment.
Well, I can say I just published a book called Competition Policy.
Yay.
And the Control of Buyer Power, a Global Issue, that is an effort to try to bring together what we know about and what we ought to do about the abuses of buyer power. It's terribly, terribly important in agriculture. What we've been talking about, whether you're a dairy farmer, a cattle feeder, a hog feeder,
right,
a poultry producer, but it goes all across our economy.
Yes,
there are all kinds of suppliers who are being abused in a world in which enforcement agencies don't seem to care very much about increased concentration in buyer power.
Yeah.
So that's my hobby horse these days has been to keep saying we've really got to see our antitrust enforcement be as concerned with harm to producers as with harm to consumers.
Yes.
And the ideology of antitrust as it stands today is somehow tied tightly to something that's called consumer welfare, and therefore we leave out harms to producers from consideration. And that's a deep and profound error, as we talked about.
Yeah.
Farmers were primary advocates for the antitrust laws. Because of their concerns, they were adopted. And farmers are deeply concerned, with the harms to them that result from buyer power.
Yes.
So it's trying to get greater focus on the buyer power issues is one of my big, big concerns.
Well, send me your book. I will send you an email and let you know where to send it. And we will I will read it, and we will talk about your book after I'm done with this dairy series. Thank you so very much, Peter Carstensen, for being on my program. I enjoyed our discussion immensely, and I'm terribly grateful to you for helping us understand some of these underlying complex issues that explain why rural America is essentially failing for no particular reason other than consolidation. So until next time, folks, thanks for listening. Thank you very much to my sponsor, the Hearst Ranch, and we'll be back next week with another great show. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.